topic for our board meeting this month, insurance.
Thank you, Hans. So this afternoon, we'll be discussing papers 2A to 2D. So papers 2A to 2D. There are a number of questions throughout court which should hopefully keep things lively. So,
do you want lively?
I think we had enough this week.
If you just all vote yes, I'm also happy, yes. Maybe I'll just scrap my tea up and let's go straight to the questions. Okay, so in accordance with the ISV's tentative decisions, insurance contracts are measured using current assumptions, and the effect of changes in market variables are recognized in the statement of comprehensive income. Today, we are only talking about presentation. In particular, the disaggregation of changes in the liability arising from changes in market variables between profit and loss and OCI. The ISB has decided on the mechanics for the accounting for contracts without participating features, but has yet to make any decision on the approaches applicable to contracts with participation features. Our approach, as a gentle reminder, is to look at what adaptations are needed to the decisions made for contracts without participating features. Accordingly, this month, staff are asking for decisions for contracts with participation features. I will just give a brief outline of all the papers so that we understand the roadmap, if you like, of this the next 2 hours. In regards to the disaggregation of changes in discount rates between profit and loss and OCI, Agenda Paper 2B considers the practical mechanics overall for contracts with participation features. So it's an overall view. Agenda Paper 2C considers whether different requirements, i.e. the current period book year, should be applied when there are no economic mismatches. Agenda Paper 2D then discusses two other issues that are remaining. One, the accounting policy choice between a cost or current measurement for the insurance investment expense and simplified transitional requirements for doing so. So as a general reminder, contracts with participation features are accounted for under A, the general model. The general model has requirements to accommodate those participation features. And the changes in the measurement of the insurance contract arising from changes in market variables are two things. One, the effect arising from applying a current discount rate. And secondly, there are changes in the nominal amounts of cash flows that are paid out to the policyholder for some of these contracts. Secondly, the board has decided on a variable fee approach for direct participation contracts. Under that approach, the insurance contract is viewed as an obligation to pay the policyholder an amount equal to the fair value of the underlying items less a variable fees service. The change in the market variables there is the 100% change in the fair value of the underlying items, which is recognized in the Statement of Comprehensive Income. In Agenda Paper 2A, it sets out, as a bit of background, the previous discussions the board has had, including its decisions in the 2013 ED. It does not contain any questions for the board. But at this stage, I'd like to stop and see if there are any questions on Agenda Paper 2A.
Thank you. I just would like to clarify the term of market variables. In the previous papers, we didn't use this term. Instead, we used the change in return on underlying items. I think you have changed it to the market variables. And I think this is necessary because you didn't want to use the term underlying items. So I appreciate that. However, it creates another confusion. That is the one of my friend who is dealing with non-par contract said that non-par contract have market variables which affect the nominal amount of cash flow in non-par contract, which is the surrender ratio. So if you have a non-par contract and you have a guarantee of 5%, and then if the interest goes up, then many policyholders will leave that contract. So therefore, surrender ratio goes up. Eventually, nominal cash flow amount would change if you measure it in portfolio basis. And if you look at the paper 2D, paragraph 19, which defines the non-par contract, paragraph 19 says, for contract without participation feature, i.e. contract in which changes in market variable do not affect the amount of cash flows. But, you know, as I said, non-par contract, which may affect the cash flow amount, caused by surrender ratio, would imagine that then my contract would not be a non-par contract. So that causes confusion. So therefore, I think we can improve the terminology a little more if your intention is not like this.
I think our intention isn't that. Our intention is these changes arise from market variables and in fact these additional benefits that are paid to the policyholder arising from the participation feature.
Right.
So perhaps we again need to look at the wording and clarify, but it's the effect on the participation feature which affects how much cash flow
amounts are paid to the
policyholder. These are additional benefits.
Additional benefits.
Are those in addition to those
right.
that you need to pay or commensurate to the loss suffered or the insured event?
Yeah, I think it must be made clear in order to avoid unnecessary
misunderstanding. Yes, we can definitely look at clarifying that.
Okay, thank you.
A small question, maybe a stupid question, about the description in 2A. You don't mention the guarantees. You said changes in market variables always go somewhere in the statement of comprehensive income. But my understanding is that the change in the value of the guarantee goes against the CSM, so it doesn't go to the... But either guarantees could be linked to changes in market variables, no?
I think that's correct. I think under the variable fee approach, you determined the changes in the variable fee as the net of two things, the changes, the 100% change in the fulfillment value and the 100% change in the fair value. So some of the impact of the guarantee essentially goes to the CSM.
They always go to... except maybe for the guarantees when they go against the CSM, right?
Yes,
okay.
I think that's correct. Yes, in the variable fee approach, it's only the 100% change in the fair value of the underlying items that hit the statement of comprehensive income.
Okay, can we proceed with paper 2B?
Okay, so in agenda paper 2B, we discussed two issues, and the first one is the smaller issue, and then the second one is the weightier one. The first one is to discuss where in the statement of comprehensive income should changes in cash flow amounts resulting from changes in market variables be presented. Now, again, changes in cash flow amounts are those changes arising from the participation feature. The second question in this paper is the mechanics for disaggregating changes in market variables between profit and loss and OCI for contracts with participation features. So let's look at the first question, which is in paragraph 7-9, where in the statement of comprehensive income should changes in cash flow amounts resulting from changes in market variables be presented? In the 2013 ED, those changes in cash flows were reported in profit and loss. However, staff thinks that those changes in cash flows would be probably better presented consistently with changes in discount rates. This is because both the changes in these cash flows and the changes in discount rates are a result of changes in market variables. So accordingly, staff are recommending that changes in these cash flows will be treated consistently with changes in discount rate. And that is question one on page 4.
All agree?
Okay. Can I ask a question? Are there any circumstances in the variable fee approach, changes in market variables can go to the CSM. Are there any circumstances where you have a participating contract that isn't in the variable fee approach when there could be a change to the CSM? I'm thinking of the change in discretion. Can a market variable prompt a change in discretion which then adjusts CSM?
I think where the board has landed up in regards to adjusting the CSM at present is to say that the principle is that you adjust the CSM for changes that relate to future services. And as part of that, changes in discretion could relate to changes in future services. I think if by putting the changes in market variables in the statement of comprehensive and changes relating to future services in the CSM, the entity will need to decide what the appropriate way of disaggregating those changes are.
So there could be a link between market variables and future services?
Could be.
But doesn't it sort of depend on what you mean by discretion? Because if you really have discretion then, and you choose to exercise it in a particular way, it may correlate to the market variable, but it's not necessarily caused by the market variable because you are in fact exercising your discretion.
What I'm unclear about is this discretion bit.
But is that question related to this question, or is that a separate question?
Well, I'm unsure how to answer this question.
Martin, can you answer this question?
No, I have another question.
Oh. Okay,
is that right?
Mary.
You can't answer the question.
I know you can't do that. It was your turn.
I'm disappointed in your faith in my inability to answer. I think that this question is saying, if you are disaggregating and presenting the changes, the effect of the change in discount rate in OCI, then you basically your decision regarding where you present the rates, change in rates, is determinative for here. So it when you say follows the presentation of discount rate, that's what you mean.
Yes.
Okay. One comment, observation about how we express that decision we made in the general about having a choice. Reading this paper in the appendix reminded me of the importance we placed when we issued the 2013 ED on the information value of disaggregation between underwriting and investing. Now, we made a decision. And not try to backtrack on that, to say we aren't going to require that disaggregation, and you can instead elect to present all the changes in discount rates in profit or loss. But I think somebody asked me to explain why. I would say because we were convinced that the cost of having to disaggregate didn't provide enough additional information to make, you know, to make the benefit exceed the cost, and we'll let entities decide rather than us specifying when you do that. But I think then that rather than presenting it as you have a free choice about what to do, we did have an objective of providing separate information about underwriting and investment. And I think I just want at some point to come back and say, having given that alternative in the general, and I would agree with then following it here, it should be consistent, that we should think about our original objective about providing insights into those two different legs of performance. And I don't have a specific suggestion for how we do it, but I think want to put in a hurdle or a point for consideration, thinking of our disclosure discussions this morning about an entity making that choice has to think about, if the why it is making that choice rather than just expressing it as, and you have a free choice, because we did have this information objective before. So agree with the staff recommendation in question one, now that I'm sure I understand it, but also want to think about how we express it more generally. And the last thing, and I think it might be related to Steve's question, but I'm not sure, is the do changes in market variables that in fact impact investment ever relate to future service? How do we decide if it relates to future service or past service? Can you just walk me through the mechanics, not in horrible detail, but in the kind of detail that says I now have a revised, I have an expected rate of return on this contract. The reason we are under the variable fee approach recognizing some gains and losses as an offset to CSM is because it's changing our expectation of profit over the contract. So are we saying, okay, here's our revised expectation, here's how much we've done to date, that proportion done to date times the revised margin equals a cum catch in the current period? Or is it that's just a revision to the estimate and it's all spread over the future period? So the latter says that none of it relates to past services. The former says that there's some split between past and future. Have I stumped the staff in the way?
Well, I was trying to figure out what the additional question is. So as far as I understand it, you're asking under the variable fee approach.
Yeah. First.
Correct.
Right.
Okay.
So under
the variable fee category.
Yes. In the variable fee approach, you've got a change of 100% of the fair value of the underlying items.
Yes.
All of that goes to the statement of comprehensive income.
Correct.
Then you've got a change in the fulfillment cash flow as your offsetting entry, and your other offsetting entry is your CSM.
Right.
So it is the difference between the 100% change in the fair value of the underlying items and the change in your fulfillment cash flows relating to the future in that period, and that is the CSM adjustment.
Right, and so we're putting all of it in the CSM, implicitly saying it all relates to future services, rather than saying it's a revision to our expectation of profitability of the contract as a whole, and we recognize some, you know, in future periods and some via a cum catch, so there's no cum catch is what you're saying. It's all spread
in
future.
I think that's what I'm saying.
I think it is too, because I did some examples that both ways, and if you take it all to the CSM, I think, Joe, you told me it would all be taken to the CSM and none of it would hit P&L as relating to past service. So I think that's right.
Martin?
Yeah, I mean, this question that should be consistent. I don't understand why it should be consistent. Because man couldn't be a situation where a company with participating features maybe has some assets which are, let's assume, equity securities which have to fair value P&L. Another portion is maybe then debt securities which is fair value OCI. And therefore they think it is better reflect if on the liability side they would have maybe discount rate changes in OCI and then other market variable changes in P&L, and couldn't be a situation where that makes more sense and gives more an economic picture than if you're requiring to be consistent. So I don't understand why it should be consistent.
I think when the feedback we got during the 2013 ED was that many saw that both are a result of one thing, changes in market variables,
yeah,
the cash flows and the discount rate. Yeah. And for them, they would rather recognize that all in one place, whatever that place may be.
But on the asset side, they cannot replace
this.
This question is
not about OCI or not OCI.
Yeah.
It says everything just goes to SCR. Later, we get to what goes to OCI and what goes to profit and loss.
Whether you have the accounting policy choice then to then put everything in profit and loss or disaggregate between profit and loss and OCI.
So
I just wanted to respond to the first point that Mary made to see if I was understanding what she meant and whether what you were going to do with it. Because I wasn't sure whether Mary was saying that we should explain, say, in the basis that our original objective was the split between underwriting and investment, but for cost reasons we didn't end up necessarily with that split, and therefore we allowed a choice, or whether Mary was suggesting that we tell people that when they make the choice, they should be doing so with this sort of objective in mind, subject to cost, because I thought it was an unconstrained choice based on our previous decisions.
That relates to Agenda Paper 2D. If you like, we can go to Agenda Paper 2D now.
No, it's okay.
I think in Agenda Paper 2D, you made the decision not just solely on cost. You gave the accounting policy choice for two reasons. One is sometimes you can address accounting mismatches more in a much holistic way, or eliminate more by going to accounting to put all the current measurements in profit and loss. And then secondly is the cost reason. But you've also given that in your accounting policy choice, and I'm trying to find the words here, you've said, I think, find the words. You said you have to consider certain things. So in paragraph 4B, in paper 2D, this accounting policy choice, when you do it, you have to consider groups of similar contracts. You need to take into consideration the portfolio in which the contracts are included. You need to take into consideration the assets that the entity holds and how those assets are accounted for. This is your previous tentative decision on the accounting policy choice for contracts without participation features.
I'm happy to wait till 2D, so,
yeah.
So, the conversation has come full circle, and the answer to this question that you posed, I had in my head, was, it depends. And the reason is it depends on the outcome to the answer in paper 2D, from my mind, to question one. And the reason is, the more I study this issue, the more I'm convinced that we absolutely need an option for both non-par and par for the use of a current interest rate. And in fact, what happened when we went down the path of adopting the OCI approach is that we just assumed that the accounting on the asset side, meaning the trying to achieve a cost-based measurement in P&L, should essentially be the measurement objective for the liability. Mm-hmm. And I think there's the flaw potentially in the measurement to this. So without an option, I'd be reticent to agree to this. I think with an option, it gets better. And frankly, when in fact the measurement objective is stated as using a current rate, which I know was discussed and debated in the basis in the 2013 ED and rejected, I actually think the quality of the information improves. Because when you are measuring changes in market variables in P&L on a cost-based, you know, measurement approach, you get these very unexplainable outcomes. And this is what Stephen has been talking about for years, and I completely agree with him. Use of OCI is critical for this model, but use of a cost-based measurement in P&L is not critical. In fact, I think it's undesirable the more I look at it. So I would rather go to the current approach for the use of OCI. So my vote is subject to actually the outcome in 2D.
I don't know whether I oversimplified the section when I was reading it. The way I thought about this was simply to say that if interest rates go up and I have a variable rate liability, I expect to pay more because I'm paying higher interest rates. I want to discount those higher interest rates at the higher rate, which is now the return. But our model would ordinarily say the change in cash flows goes to CSM, the change in interest rate goes to goes to SCI. And I had read the question as simply saying, would I prefer to see those two things going to the same place? Mm. Now, in that context, I think for me it's quite an easy answer, and it feels to me like we may be bringing a few too many other complications into play here. I do agree with Stephen that we need to think a little bit about how discretion plays into this, because discretion is sometimes simply me choosing to pay more in a higher interest rate or pay less in a lower interest rate. The problem is discretion is not always that. Discretion can be a number of other things. I think in the context of discretion being me choosing to pay higher amounts in a higher interest rate environment, my answer here would be yes. In the context of discretion being to do something else, my answer would be no. But it feels to me a little bit like we might be dragging in an awful lot of other complexity.
Can I
essentially a simple question.
The reason why, in my mind, it's questionable is because the question asks whether or not they should be reported consistently in SCI. That means you could have one part of this in P&L and one part in OCI.
Well, I don't think that's
consistently
the
in profit and loss. Then I would say yes.
So
no problem. But it doesn't ask that question.
Let me ask Joe a slightly different question then. Was the assumption here when you said consistently that you want to report both the change in cash flows and the change in discount rate, ideally on the same line or in the same place? That same place is somewhere in SCI. If I've chosen OCI, both would be in OCI. If I've chosen profit and loss, both.
That's not the question.
I think that's what the question is intended to be.
Yes, that was your question. I agree.
It was
yes.
Just somewhere in SCI.
Yeah, exactly. But consistently
but
in the same place.
But you're not.
But consistently in the same place.
It. Yeah, you're going to put the change in cash flows in profit and loss and the change in discount rates in OCI. You need to put the two together because essentially, in a perfect world, those two should offset. If my cash flows go up because my interest rates...
I completely agree with you, but that's not what the question
is.
But then I think it might just
but
be...
Now so I'd understood the simpler version of the question, perhaps. So perhaps the question to Joe is that what the question was?
Yes, that is what the question is. I couldn't word it like that because I cannot... I'm only asking about the accounting policy choice in 2D.
Right.
Yes?
Okay, now that we have understood what the question was...
No, but now I'm confused.
Sure
really. I don't understand it now. I thought it was not my question, but what is it now?
I thought Martin got the opposite answer before.
Yeah, what is now the question, really?
If the discount rates go to profit and loss, the changes in cash flow also go to profit and loss. If the changes in discount rate go to OCI, the changes in cash flow go to OCI.
Exactly. That was what I expected, but you said it was not the question.
Yeah. No, I think perhaps, your concern, I think, Martin, was, as I understood it, was slightly different, which is if my underlying assets are equities, and my changes in cash flows and changes in rates go to one place, do they both go to the same place as equities, in other words, profit and loss? And I think that is the different question. If my underlying assets are bonds and I've elected to go to OCI, then I take interest rates and cash flows to OCI. And I think that is the separate question. This question is simply, do the changes in future cash flows and the changes in future discount rate go to the same place?
Okay.
Somewhere in SCI, whatever your accounting policy is.
I think that
it's not CSM versus CSM. I think
so.
This
to either P&L or OCI. So we're talking the same place within SCI.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Just let me.
This was a small item, so I would hope that we can spent not too much time on it, Philippe.
Also relatively small items, matter of wording. You are introducing a new terminology, investment expense. I'm not sure that really communicates very well. I know investment income based on my investments, but usually I don't expense my investments, right? In the framework, investment is not an expense. Can you think of a better word to describe the fact that you pass on to your policyholders the income received from your investment and they participate directly, so you pass on to them 100%, 95%, whatever, of this investment income. It does not make it an investment expense. It is an insurance expense in a way, rather than an investment expense. So I'm not sure about that term. It just, in my opinion, confuses the whole messaging because it's not consistent with usual terminology.
We are open for suggestions. The reason we changed it is other board members didn't like the term interest expense because it was not clearly interest.
I agree, it's not only interest expense, it's more than that, but to make it an investment expense, that is just a contradiction between the terms because I don't expense my investments according to the framework.
Stephen.
To answer the question, I'm happy with the question for the reason that Daryl gave. The only reason I flanked my question earlier was, it's really a question of what happens to the CSM. It's not so much these things, because they should go to SCI. And in fact, even for the variable fee approach, these things also go to SCI. It's just that we have an adjustment to CSM, which partially or fully offsets it. So I'm just flagging that I'm not convinced that there is no adjustment to CSM as a consequence.
That is what I want to confirm. In the previous meeting, we discussed about the difference between the cash flow and the CSM, cash flow and discretion. Cash flow based on the financial assumption and the cash flow based on the discretion. Say, let's take an example of the situation like interest rate changed from 5% to 3%. And obviously, the cash flow which you promised to pay would decrease because previously you promised 5%, but now it's decreased to 3%. Total cash flow decreases. And then the discount rate changes as well. However, in order to catch up that decrease, if you pay discretionary payment on top of that 3% to fill up 2% gap, that goes to the CSM. That is my understanding in the previous meeting. Is it still correct?
The entity will need to decide what changes arises from changes of market variables and what arises from changes of discretion.
Discretion, that's up to the judgment of the entity. Right, okay.
Can I see who can support the staff recommendation?
As amended, as you described the intention, right?
Yes. So I will put in the same location in the statement of comprehensive income.
13.1. No.
And subject to 2D.
Well, isn't that the whole subject that we're going to come on to?
Yep.
Sorry?
The bit about in the same location.
I
think that's the subject that we're coming on to.
Shall we have the discussion? We'll come back and take the votes.
So the second part of the paper discusses the desegregation of changes in market variables. Just as a brief reminder, in paragraph 10, it outlines the previous methods or mechanics, which are just variations of the effective yield approach. So staff are recommending that in the forthcoming standard, that not to prescribe detailed mechanics for doing so, but instead rely on the objective that the insurance investment expense should be presented using a cost measurement basis in profit and loss. Commonly, the differences in determining the insurance investment expense using a cost measurement basis and a current measurement basis will be presented in OCI. Staff recommends this because it would avoid complex requirements in the standard that would be needed to be tailored for the various contracts with participating features that exist today. Just as a reminder, this doesn't deal with Agenda Paper 2C, which is, again, the current period book yield and whether to bring in a current period book yield, and also the accounting policy choice, which is discussed in Agenda Paper 2D. So putting those two aside, this is slowly on, do you wish to express it as an objective and not prescribe detailed mechanics?
Mary?
I think I do. I have some concern that specifying detailed mechanics will permanently enshrine certain ways of doing things that as practices evolve may no longer be as appropriate. So I think it's better to focus on the principles. I wanted to check whether doing it this way would say when you are disaggregating, and that's subject to the discussions about are you disaggregating or do you have an option not to disaggregate, but when you're disaggregating, that your objective should be to have a cost measure in the P&L. And so I think that means that it says this is what you focus on and then all else goes there, as opposed to I can argue that I try and measure, you know, what I'm trying to capture elsewhere, and then the balance goes into P&L. It's no, your objective has to be a cost measure in P&L, and what's left is the residual.
Yeah, that's correct. So it's subject to your accounting policy decision, which is in 2D.
If you have that decision.
Yes, if you have the decision in 2D.
I would just reiterate what I just said again, which is my response to this will be subject to the decision in 2D. To me, it's critical that the option exists.
Doc? Thank you. I like this idea. I like the idea, background idea, I like very much. Because the insurance business is, in a sense, local business. Although the name is same, the businesses are quite different in every jurisdiction. But on the other hand, insurance is very old business. They have own historic background. So therefore, if you try to enforce particular method, then it could be embraced by some companies or some jurisdiction, but it could penalize some company or some jurisdiction. That would happen. So therefore, I think even in spite of your, you know, effort to find out the best way, I don't think it's really possible. So therefore, I do like this idea to have objective and do not decide precise method. actually, you know, project is something like that. The other day, I bought the bookshelf.
Oh.
And I was trying to screw each corner. And I screwed three corners and tried to fix the last one. But there is a big gap. Because I tightened each screws too much. And there is a big gap.
It's the first time you screwed an IKEA.
Yes. I should have loosened the screw a little more. And then, if I try too hard to meet it, then I broke the bookshelf. And the other thing is, I made a very, you know, very stable, fixed bookshelf. But when I was trying to put my book, it didn't get in.
Too
small. So then the bookshelf itself was useful. So therefore, what I want to say is that because the, you know, insurance standard is something like making bookshelves. There are a variety of books in the size and tolls and whatever. You have to put everything in so that make it flexible. So I really like this idea.
That's up there with your wife's handbag.
Story makes me think twice.
So we've exchanged lots of emails on this.
But on the bookshelf.
Steve first bespoke.
I'm happy with a cost objective, and it sounds so simple and easy and that, but the difficulty is going to be getting at least some consistency, comparability for investors. You know, we know they're going to rely on this P&L. You know, I don't think these things should go into OCI in the first place. But so what's left in P&L, the fact is people are going to rely on it. So we need something that's going to at least give an element of comparability and not just a free choice. So when we have cost in other parts of our literature, we specify fairly clearly what we mean by cost. So in IFRS 9, we use cost for many instruments, and we have this EIR notion, and we know pretty much what it is. And there are some unanswered questions, and we talked about variable rate bonds that in OCI and the like. But for example, if you purchase a zero coupon bond, if we didn't have anything in IFRS 9 saying what cost is, you could interpret cost to be the purchase price. But that would be inconsistent with IFRS 9, because cost is the purchase price accreted, and accreted at the single EIR. And if we didn't specify that, you could end up with different people getting to different numbers. Purchase price, cost accreted at an EIR, cost accreted using different points on the yield curve, and you would end up with different figures. So we specify in IFRS 9 what we mean by cost. Cost is a convention, it's a bunch of rules, it's not really an objective. So as you know, I'm happy with this, but I feel we need to pin it down.
I was going to say something similar to Stephen, because when I looked at this, I wrote in the margin that cost is in the eye of the beholder, because I know that when I talk to a lot of people about financial instruments, they really think cash accounting when we talk about amortized cost, and they really take time to get their heads around the zero coupon bond type example that Steve uses. So, but I do agree with not having a sort of manual on how to do calculations in the document. So I wonder whether it would be helpful to talk about something such as having an objective of allocating the, I don't know, the amounts over the life of the liability. So trying to pick up some of the ideas behind the effective interest approach in 9 without pinning it to that. But this idea of allocation of the yield over the life of the instrument, I think, is what we mean when we say cost. And then at least we give people a better idea of what they're aiming for without telling them how to do the numbers.
Does the staff agree with this suggestion?
Yes, I think what we could do is, firstly, you know, perhaps have in the application guidance to say that the objective, the mechanics, would be this allocation of the interest accretion of over the life of the contract in a systematic way, and that points to a way that's consistent throughout the life of the contract. The other thing that staff could look at is the examples that were given in the paper could be used as well as examples of the four ways that could be used to do the cost method.
Yep.
Thank you. Maybe related to Steve's and Sue's. Long time ago, Connor gave a quite good lesson to us about how the mechanics of this effective yield approach and current period book yield approach. Just I'm wondering, this effective yield approach will be updated every period. So is there any big difference, you know, in terms of numbers, final numbers, between this updated effective yield approach and this current period book yield approach?
Can we get onto that when we discuss current period book yield? Because this is merely about the effective yield approach.
Yeah, I understand. But Steve's question is quite related because what is the real cost is, and there are actually all the assumptions we are going to update it about it. We are saying this is cost-based model. FASB yesterday, they explained that their model. I asked that they are using any name, not using any name of their measurement model, cost or current band. They're just updating all assumptions, but they're using their kind of a locked-in rate, like an effective yield approach, to present the current interest expense. So I'm saying, you know, conceptually it's quite difficult to identify which is a cost-based, which is a cost when we have a kind of updated assumptions. Another thing is a likely effect of these two approaches in real world in terms of the interest expense. That's why I'm asking.
The cost-based assumption only relates to changes in market variables and not the other assumptions. So when you're talking about this approach, you're only talking about cost-based assumptions for the market changes in market variables and nothing else.
Nothing.
I think though, to answer your question of the difference between the two, I think for me, I think about what CBY, what current book yield is trying to achieve. It's looking at an underlying asset book that comprises both fair value profit and loss items and amortized cost or fair value OCR. Split out for the moment the fair value profit and loss because that's not relevant to this particular discussion. What you're then looking at is CBY is trying to capture the cost approach or the cost measurement of the underlying assets that are measured either at cost or at fair value OCR. And I think that's exactly consistent with what this says. The difficulty with CBY is CBY deals with both fair value profit and loss and with fair value OCI and amortized cost. But I think the objective is the same.
I think the objective is different. I think the objective of current in Agenda Paper 2 there is a cost measurement basis. It is inherent in a cost measurement basis to have potential accounting mismatches between the assets that you hold and the cost that you hold. That is what cost does. I think in current period book yield, your objective is different. Your objective is to eliminate accounting mismatch in profit.
I shouldn't have said objective. That was the wrong
term.
The outcome for the component of the asset book that is measured at either cost or at fair value OCI is that the liability measurement will reflect the asset measurement. The asset measurement is a cost-based measurement. The liability is now measured using a cost-based element. So I think the outcome is the same. The objective was a poor word.
Yes. The outcome is likely to be the same, yes.
Having heard this discussion, who can support the recommendation?
With the modification.
With the modification, yes.
With the pinning down.
All right. So
14.
So one again. Oh, no.
No, 14.
14. Okay. Thank you. So we've already started talking about the current period book yield in Agenda Paper 2C. And in Agenda Paper 2C, we outline that another method or another way of achieving a different objective is this current period book yield. Just as a reminder, the objective in Agenda Paper 2B is a cost measurement objective, and it is inherent in that accounting mismatches will arise. The question here is, in situation where there is no economic mismatches, would the board want to modify that objective to eliminate accounting mismatches in profit and loss? Paragraphs 3-6 of the paper.
Chair, you wrote that down somewhere, I didn't understand it. Where there's no mismatches, we want to eliminate the mismatch.
Accounting mismatches in profit
and loss.
Where
there's no economic mismatches, you want to eliminate accounting.
paragraphs 3-6 of the paper provides context on the current peer book queue. Before we ask the board to vote on whether to modify the objective for current peer book queue, we would like first to discuss what happens when the entity is required to change the approach between the current peer book yield approach and the effective yield approach because of changes in this economic mismatches. And that's in paragraphs 9-21. So we're just going to have a discussion first about paragraphs 9-21. There are three major questions in that section. The first one is the more difficult question, is how do you treat the accumulated balance of OCI when moving between the approaches? Either way, what would you do? This is really broken down into two sub-questions. First of all, do you need to restate the opening balance of accumulated OCI, similar to a kind of retrospective transition type approach where you restate things as if you applied the newly qualified approach all the way throughout the life of the contract? So to put it in simple terms, let's say you've moved from the effective yield approach to the current period book yield approach. Should you restate the accumulated OCI as if you used the current period book yield approach across the entire life of the contract up to that day? That's the first question. We have recommended no, you shouldn't restate the accumulated OCI. If you do not restate the accumulated OCI, then the question remains, there might be a balance in the accumulated OCI on the date of the change. What do you do with that balance of accumulated OCI? And in the paper, we've outlined three alternatives. You could recycle that profit and loss straight away. You could recognize it over the life of the contract using the assumptions at the date that this change occurred. And finally, the staff recommendation, which is to let it remain in equity, never recognize it in profit and loss. And then the second question is, how should you restate comparative information? And the third question is, which disclosures should apply? So that's paragraphs 9-21. And we'd like to open that for discussion before we move on to what the current peer book, whether the board wishes to apply the current peer book yield approach. So can we start first perhaps with what should happen with the opening balance of the accumulated OCI? And that is from paragraphs 12-18.
Joe, I apologize. I'm just having trouble getting in gear fast enough with some of these. But in the last paper, we just talked about having a clear objective for measurement of cost, assuming that there's disaggregation, either mandatory or optional, having a clear objective of cost for the profit or loss. And this paper 2C seems to be talking about shifting to an objective of eliminating accounting mismatches, which seems to run counter to the previous objective.
That's correct.
Of having an objective of measuring costs.
That's correct.
So we are talking about having just said before, we're going to have an objective of measuring costs. We're not going to specify how to, although we may say a bit more about what is cost. We're saying, well, now are we always going to really have an objective of cost, or in some circumstances are we going to flip it to?
Yes.
Okay.
It's an exception.
So in the case in agenda paper 2B, when you have a cost measurement objective, it is extremely complicated to eliminate accounting mismatches in profit and loss, because an inherent feature of a cost measurement system is that accounting mismatches may arise between the assets and liabilities.
And that's maybe one reason why you might want to recognize all of your changes in one place rather than disaggregation.
That's correct. That's
and you're
correct.
Saying, but should we give people the further alternative of
that's
not
right.
only using one place to eliminate it, but also a modification of the calculation
yes.
so that it isn't really cost anymore, but it eliminates accounting mismatches?
Yes. Yes. So eliminating accounting mismatches when your assets are held at cost. And you can do this in a simpler way when there are no economic mismatches between the assets that you hold, or it could be more than the assets, but for the purposes, it's easier to think of just assets and the liability. And that's the purpose of this paper. So the first question we're going to ask in this paper is, do you want to make that modification to that objective you've already decided on? But before we do that, we thought it would be helpful to understand the complexity that would arise by bringing in a modified objective.
If you make that objective, you realize you're going to have to solve all the following.
Yes, you need to answer these following questions. What do you do when you're switching between these two objectives? The first question is, what do you do with the accumulated OCI when you're switching? And that's paragraphs 12 to 18 again. And then there's the comparative information, and then there's the disclosures. So thank you, Mary. I think that was good to just.
Granted, there is a degree of complexity that is applied, but you somewhere indicate that there will be no accounting policy choice in respect of using CBI. It would be a mandatory system. And then everyone has to apply this and to follow the, to suffer the complexity. What if CBI was an optional thing, and then people would have to choose that with complexity or not do it?
In agenda paper 2D, the accounting policy choice is either CBY or current measurement basis in profit and loss. But if you select to choose to disaggregate changes in market variables between profit and loss and OCI, and you meet the requirements of CBY, then yes, it would be mandatory.
Why? I'm not sure I understand why, because whenever we have a system which is a cost base, which is good as an objective but has some flaws, either people live with that or they want to go further, and then there is complexity with that, but why enforce that on everyone? I mean, why not let some choose the complexity and others go to imperfect system, which is cost, or fair value cost and cost in the P&L? So I'm not sure about this.
So your option is actually, you would also make, if you're choosing to disaggregate changes in market variables between profit and loss and OCI, and you happen to meet the qualifications of current period book yield, you would allow them to choose either the effective yield approach or the current period book yield. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. So I think we can discuss that as well as part of that when we come to answer, 2D, or even at the end when you want to bring in, whether you want to bring in current period book yield. So I think that it's a valid question.
General?
So I'll answer the three questions I think you've just asked as a starting point and get back to CBY later, I think.
Yeah.
Your paragraph 13, I think, is exactly right in that what we're doing is we're picking up a change in circumstances between one period and the next. So based on that, I do not believe you should restate the opening balance of OCI, because I think the OCI balance was built up over a period of time due to things that have really happened in the past and that were accounted for in that way. So I wouldn't restate my opening balance. I also wouldn't change my comparators for exactly the same reason. I think those two things are absolutely correct. I think that's reflecting the fact that there is a change in the actual economic circumstances if I'm changing from the one method to the other. The one that I struggle with a little bit more is that I do not ever recognize or recycle out of OCI the profit or loss that is being captured in OCI. Now, I realize that any type of recycling mechanism that we put in place there is by its nature going to be a lot more complicated. And I think that is certainly something that we should be considering when we decide whether or not CBY should come in. But for me, the fact that we wouldn't recognize a profit because of what amounts to potentially a very simple change in mechanics between one period and the next is relatively troubling here. So I must be honest, if I were to go with this, I would say no to restating comparators, mm-hmm. No to opening balance, but I would go down your option, I forget now.
15A, I think it is.
15A. So yeah. Essentially the option that says that you would track the profit and loss over time. As I say, I realize the consequence of that is to make this a lot more complicated, and that would then
kick back into my thinking about CBY.
Yes.
But that would be my preferred outcome. And I think it's twofold. Firstly, I think that's a better recognition of what is happening in the entity over time. So the profits are real, the losses are real. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I think it does, if we leave it as is, it does create the opportunity to, shall we say, engineer the result you want.
Stephen? So the problem we really have in all of this is that cost is not really a relevant measurement basis for insurance contracts. And in the balance sheet, we have them at current value, and they're complex things. And trying to use cost is very difficult because they're complex. And in IFRS 9, we don't allow cost if something doesn't meet the SPPI principle and therefore isn't simple. And the more complex we make the contracts, or the contracts become, such as the participating contracts, the more difficult it becomes to identify cost. And the ironic thing is, this current period book yield, I mean, it's a very neat way of solving the problem, but in actual fact, the net outcome of it is zero in OCI. So it's all rather pointless. Because you have an OCI amount on the asset and you mirror it with an OCI amount on the liability, so the net effect in OCI is nothing, and the net effect on P&L is nothing.
Unless the asset is amortized cost.
Yes,
there will be an OCI amount if the asset is at amortized cost, but pure assets will be at amortized cost, one presumes, for insurance entities. Will there certainly be fair value P&L or fair value through OCI? I don't have an answer to these complexity problems because they're sort of all of our own making, I guess. But in terms of your question about changes, I agree with Daryl and his analysis. But it would be an awful lot easier if we just didn't do it all.
Mary?
Daryl, when you talked about the alternatives in paragraph 15, you explained why not C, because you thought that this is something that should be recognized in profit or loss. I wasn't sure I understood why you were preferring A, which has the downside of additional complexity, to B, immediate recognition, which is alternative B.
The concern I have with B is a recognition of profit or loss. Without an underlying economic event that has happened to justify that recognition of profit or loss. So all that's happened is I have, because of a change in the accounting mechanics of applying OCI, a profit and loss pops out. Now I've got to decide what to do with the profit or loss. I read one as essentially saying I will spread that profit or loss over the remaining life of the contract, and which one is it now? Two saying I will recognize that profit or loss immediately. Recognizing it immediately is uncomfortable for me because there hasn't actually been an event to give rise to it. So essentially, what I'm doing in two is I say that I have an amortized cost method, and now I change the method to profit and loss and recognize the profit and loss. Change it to fair value and recognize the profit and loss.
I'm going to ask you the question of the moment, because I agreed with your analysis of paragraph 12, 13, 14, the idea that it's a change in circumstances, so therefore you shouldn't have restatement, etc. And what could you remind me what the change in circumstances are that would lead you to qualify or no longer qualify? Because and the reason I'm asking this, just so I don't set up a trap, is because you said the only event that occurs is a change in accounting, so you don't see why that should lead to recognition. But it seems like the underlying event is a change in circumstances that leads you to qualify or not. So you seem to be saying that underlying change in the circumstances shouldn't lead to...
So in part, for me, it's dependent on how we exactly end up defining CBY. But if we argue that CBY is only valid in circumstances where I have 100% match between my assets and my liabilities,
mm-hmm.
and I now have a circumstance where that 100% match breaks down, it becomes something other than 100%. In that circumstance, and that might be because I've added new insurance assets, new insurance contracts, and my contracts now don't match my assets anymore. In that circumstance, I'm going to say there's a breakdown and I need to move from CBY to effective yield. But the actual economic activity, the adding of the contracts,
doesn't reflect the underlying change in the assets. It doesn't change the rest of my liabilities, and therefore to me doesn't justify there being an event to release OCI or to recycle OCI that is tied to those liabilities.
Okay. That's fine. I was just trying to reconcile there's been a change in circumstances but there hasn't been a change in circumstances that justifies P&L recognition. And you're pointing out that the things that can trigger a shift from into and out of qualifying for current book yield can be unrelated to the items giving rise to the OCI. Okay.
Doc.
Thank you. I just want to confirm the OCI remains forever. Is there any chance to be recycled?
Under
the staff recommendation, which is C, it's not recycled.
So it remains, in a sense, forever, even
yes.
if the contract.
And that's what Daryl and Steve
yeah.
didn't.
Okay. Yeah. Like it's a bit of a problem, but however, I really like paragraph 13. So each approach is applied in a situation that appropriate to that approach. So therefore, if I compare the benefit and the problem, although the problem is in a sense a bit big because OCI remains forever, but I appreciate the benefit of doing it. Keep the appropriate approach for each period. That would be better. But having said that, this is true for this relatively small issue, but this would be true for other issues as well. So for other transitional issues. So I think, in the case of insurance contract, as I mentioned, there are a variety of business all across the jurisdictions, and we are going to establish new standard. And the insurance business is a long business, and the contract duration is long. So therefore, this idea written in paragraph 13 could be applied to the transition of our insurance contract standard. that is my statement.
And what do you prefer in this situation?
In this situation, I agree with staff.
Okay, thank you.
Mark.
I mean, I agree with staff recommendation, but also what Daryl has said, because if say changing that method, I think it has to be amortized over the life of the contract, because otherwise you can, by choosing a method, can create P&L, which is not, I think, a good thing. And I understand it is a lot of complexity, but I think when we went through the examples, and I think when situations where there is not any economic mismatch, but we're showing in P&L that I think we need a kind of solution for that, and that was a current book yield, and I think that is now the consequence. If we're allowing that, okay, then we have to live with that. I think that is a consequence, and therefore I think if we want to eliminate this accounting mismatch, and I want to do that because I have seen it from the examples, it is okay. If you sell a kind of portfolio, then we have seen how the P&L could look like. I think we have to live with that.
But you said you agree with the staff recommendation.
Excluding what they said on question 2.
Okay.
So you support Daryl and Steve's view, basically, on that. Yeah, which is 15A. You prefer 15A?
Yeah.
Yep.
Is anyone else...
I support 15A.
I think 15A is, at least I think it's consistent with the arguments on 12, 13, and 14.
Sure. Okay.
That's why I agree with that.
Let me ask a question. What about Gary?
Yeah, the is actually, I'm sure where 15A is too. It's thinking back to the conceptual framework work, as you said, there's a presumption everything leaves OCI. Not since the standard today, but it's where we're going for the future. But I do have a question on paragraph 14. How much of your recommendation was driven by the fact it would just be very difficult to do without probably won't have the historical information versus that's just a side thought. It's not your central thinking.
That was not to do with whether you recycle the amounts out of the accumulated balance. This was whether you should restate the opening balance as if, so for example, you move from the effective yield approach to the current period yield approach. The approach I'm recommending is that you don't restate the accumulated balance as if you applied the current Puuc yield approach
but
since the beginning.
Right, but some of it's driven because of the lack of historical information, which would be useful in terms of if you're going to recycle out, you know,
yeah.
knowing when it got there in the first place.
Well, if you restated the accumulated accounting balance, the recycling question goes away because it's as if you've been applying the current period book yield since the beginning or the effective yield since the beginning. So there's not like a balance that somehow you need to deal with. It's already kind of smaller or bigger, depending on how it's applied. The reason I went for not restating the accumulated balance is because it is in this period that you qualify or you don't qualify for the current period book yield. That's the correct representation in that period.
Fact and
yeah.
circumstance, but just something leaving something in equity
is
forever is
troubling.
Troubling. I mean, now it is what it is, but.
Okay.
Right.
Why don't you reformulate first?
Yes. Before we reformulate, can we now move on to the main question in the paper, which is whether to have the current period book yield? And in paragraphs 22 to 25, staff have laid out the arguments for current period, having the modifications for the current period book yield and against the modification for the current period book yield, which then will result in asking the board to vote on question one, which is whether you wish to modify the objective. And also then we will talk about Philippe's point about whether you think it should be optional. So even if you do meet, if you do, then we can discuss if you've, because the current recommendation is if you meet those conditions of economic mismatch, you must use the current period book yield if you're choosing to disaggregate between profit and loss and OCI. So we could discuss all of that, I think, in this space. And I think Martin's already started to discuss some of that.
Sure.
So the staff do set out their arguments for and against, but I noticed a lack of staff recommendation.
Lack of what?
Staff recommendation. I looked a few times, but it's not there.
It's an invisible ink.
So my gut instinct was that it seemed like we'd made the book yield quite operational in the sense that when you're using it, it was quite clear how you'd do the calculations. And that it seemed like a good idea to remove accounting mismatches when there was no economic mismatch. So that to me sounds like quite a nice thing. And obviously it comes with complications that we've just been talking about. So is it cruel to ask the staff, given those benefits, what it was that caused you to hesitate in recommending it?
I guess we didn't put a staff recommendation because it's a very finely balanced arguments for and against.
So what in particular worries you?
I think what in particular worries us is if you're having a cost-based measure, accounting mismatches are inherent. So this will be the first time, I think, in IFRS where you'll be using the P&L and OCI to address accounting mismatches when historically we've used accounting true profit and loss. So that you'll be setting, if you like, almost a precedent.
So when you say that cost-based measures inherently have mismatches, is that because if I had my assets and liabilities both on a cost basis, I'd still get gains and losses as
yes,
a result of derecognition?
Yes, yes.
Is that what you're getting at?
Getting
you
it.
You get no mismatches if you have the asset and the liability exactly matched in duration for the whole time, in which case effective yield would already deal with that. If you buy them assets at different times, then because the cost reflects the time that you bought them, then you introduce the mismatches automatically.
And the other thing to think about is complexity. Is I was also looking at the fact that this would only apply to a subset of contracts under the variable fee approach. If you went to P&L for the assets and the P&L for the liabilities, it kind of nets off to zero. Exactly the same if you use the current period book yield. Now, granted that not all your assets can be apply the current the P&L option, but most can, and you would get almost very similar to using current period book yield with the P&L and OCI split, because a lot of the difference in the spread is adjusted against the margin. So in essence, you know, some of the objections we hear to going to P&L on both sides is the volatility concern. The board has already addressed that in a way by unlocking the margin for the variable fee.
And what you get instead is an introduction of general complexity in the model as a whole and in IFRS as a whole, and that needs to be factored against it as well.
So I think that it is very finely balanced, and that's why we felt we couldn't make a recommendation, and we brought it to those who know better.
Just interesting.
Daryl.
I looked at this as a starting point by thinking about what we've done in the non-participating space and how we've tried to set that up. And I think the decision we took earlier today was to say that we would, where you are using OCI, the objective, the intent is to try to get to a cost-based measure on the liability. And I think that's the starting point for that part. Then what we also said is that we would allow you the option to decide when you would use OCI and when you would not. And that was because we had an appreciation of the fact that the underlying assets in some cases might be measured at amortized cost, in which case it seems like a liability approach that targeted a cost-based measure was appropriate. But in other circumstances, the asset might be measured at fair value, profit and loss. And in that circumstance, allowing an entity to opt out of OCI on the liability side, again, would achieve a type of matched accounting, if you like, for both sides. The difficulty with that, obviously, in the case of non-PAR is that because the assets are not directly linked, it's very difficult for any insurer to draw a perfect dotted line between the asset and the liability, and hence it was very difficult for us to legislate how you would go about doing it, and was the background to us choosing to allow it as an option for non-PAR contracts. When I think about a PAR contract where I'm holding the exact underlying assets, I can effectively achieve precisely what we're trying to achieve for the non-PAR, but in a much simpler way, and that's the CBY is essentially a much simpler way. Now, it achieves for me, to the extent that I have cost assets, it achieves that same thing that OCI achieves for cost assets in the non-PAR model, and to the extent that I have fair value assets, it achieves the same thing as not using the OCI option for non-PAR would achieve. But it's a much simpler mechanism because it allows me to all intents and purposes, adjust this thing in a dynamic basis between the two. So I think, and this comes maybe back to Sue's point a little bit, I think the advantages of CBY are significant, but I think they're also only relevant where there is that direct match between the two. Then my comments earlier in terms of the way I would like to see the transition from CBY to effective yield, coming to the second part of your argument, Joe, which I think is about the complexity. And I think this is real complexity we're adding in the process. But to my mind, the predominant complexity we're adding is the complexity for the preparer of the financial statements. If I'm a user of the financial statements, it's pretty easy for me to understand what's happening because I've got that matched accounting approach. If I'm the preparer of the accounting statements, I have to spend an awful lot of effort and data collection, et cetera, to maintain the information to be able to do all of this. But that's fine because, well, that's fine from my perspective as long as we offer it as an option. Because then I suspect that most sensible insurers who are looking at the cost of this and understand the cost elements will choose to go current and be done because you achieve that very similar answer, or that you achieve the same answer, the same sort of outcome. For those who choose to go down the more complex route and spend the money, they've chosen to spend the money. So I'm actually comfortable with the complexity this introduces because of who it introduces to. And as I say, I would make this optional, the alternative being the current approach.
Okay.
And because they've got that option, they can choose to avoid the complexity and the cost that goes with that complexity.
So just to be clear, you're not suggesting the option that Philippe was suggesting, which was...
No, I'm suggesting...
the effective yield or the current peer book yield in these circumstances.
It's a valuation. It's a valuation.
Yeah, I think
I'd be suggesting you would switch, you would choose, if you choose OCI and you have a matched book, you must use the method that is right.
Okay.
If you choose not to use OCI, then not to use CBY, then the alternative is current.
Okay, and that's a kind of agenda paper 2D. Yeah.
Daryl, I'm a little bit intrigued by your comment that it's not complex for the user. It seems to me there's so many adjustments going through so many places for so many reasons. If I was a user, I'd find it difficult to work.
I think in my context, there's two things. The starting point is from the user perspective. Under a CBY approach, what they're seeing is that my assets are measured on a consistent basis with my liabilities, and my adjustments to OCI for my assets are consistently applied to my adjustments for liabilities. To the extent that OCI that I switch between the one method and the other. That OCI balance will simply roll out over the life. There's no hidden profit that lives forever in OCI. The profit simply comes out in the same sort of, and I think the terminology we were using earlier, on a systematic basis over the remaining life of the contract, to my mind, is consistent with the way we've applied OCI already under the effective yield approach, or the way we're talking about applying it.
Amaro?
Thanks. I think Daryl helped me, I think. Because I was struck by the, this, as I mentioned to you before, this I'm fairly comfortable with almost everything, because we are developing a specific model for a very sophisticated industry, and with lots of outreach and lots of discussion with the industry. So every time that you bring something that says that the model is complex, I think it's only an additional complexity to a model that is on a whole very complex, and it will take time to understand and to explain, and for users to be totally comfortable with the numbers and information provided by this model. So, but when it came to these paragraphs, I was really divided, and I was really not sure on how to decide between the two, because up to paragraph 24, for arguments for against modified, they're almost all of them, they talk about complexity. We are not really touching upon other aspects of the model. We say, well, you know, this is more complex. Of course, every additional optionality makes any model complex. And then I was thinking about, well, if I had to explain this to someone with an additional layer of optionality, of course, it's becoming more and more complex. Then I went to arguments for modifying, and complexity is not here anymore, but then comes the benefits of providing a more reasonable information for the users in general. So when I heard, I had this question, my original question to you would be, well, okay, is this complexity a good complexity? As sometimes the industry accepts that, well, this is the complexity that we can deal with, and we are okay with, or is this an additional layer of complexity that then they will say, well, we are not able to do that, really, for the benefit of the users. So I am sympathetic at the end of the day to somewhat follow Daryl's thinking in saying that, well, this is complex for the industry, and this model is totally new. So they will have to apply this model that we are developing. They will have enough time. We decided yesterday even to expand, tentatively decided to expand. So I'm foreseeing a number of years for them to really incorporate the model as we are proposing and develop their internal systems, and of course, communicate. So at the end of the day, this good, I'm seeing this as an additional layer of complexity as, well, can be worthwhile if we really achieve what is stressed as arguments for modify. Mm-hmm. Is this really going to, and then goes to Ian's interjection, is this really going to provide a better information for users? If it's really, if we are really comfortable in this, I would buy that. I would buy that complexity at this stage.
Stephen? I'd be quite happy to get rid of current period book yield, because I think it has no real net benefit. Amaro, you say, does it give better information to investors? I don't think it does. I mean, it doesn't really change the information. Subject to the point that Daryl made about assets at cost, but for most of those, there'll be the fair value option.
Are we live?
Yeah.
Behind you.
Okay, that one's dead. That's sorry.
Now we have the variable fee approach and that the CSM represents the present value of unearned profit, there is really little effect from the current period book yield. I guess the only reason to have it is for the sake of completeness, and then you can apply an OCI approach right across the board. And from a, I guess, a political reason, because people are so desperate to have these cost-type measures and to use OCI. But I don't really see any sort of investor or standard setting compelling reason to have the current period book yield. What I wouldn't want, though, is to say it's a different objective. I still think it's the same objective in the end. Because when we are going to have this OCI approach for the par contracts that don't qualify for current period book yield, we're going to allow companies to some flexibility about how they precisely do that allocation, that accretion. And presumably, we're happy for them to choose the basis of that accretion, taking into account the impact that it will have on accounting mismatches. So if we're going to allow that for these other par contracts, why isn't the current period book yield effectively the same thing? Why isn't it a cost-based measure, but it just happens to be a cost-based measure that has been designed in a way to eliminate the accounting mismatches?
We don't believe it's a cost-based measure because it's got nothing to do with the liability but more to do with how the assets are. So for us, it's very hard to see it as a cost-based measure. We can accept that it is a measure that will eliminate accounting mismatches that arise from the assets and the liabilities.
So when we have the effective yield method, are we going to ban effective yield approaches where the accretion takes into account the crediting rate?
The crediting rate is to do with the liability, so no.
But the crediting rate is driven by the assets.
No, but it's an actual phenomena that's happening, the liability. You're getting a statement that shows that the insurer is crediting you X amount.
But then for the direct participation contract, the change in the liability is a phenomenon of the liability, but it is driven by the assets.
But you might not credit it in that period, but nevertheless you're going to get the investment expense equal to the asset growth.
I'm struggling to see the difference.
Yeah.
Mary?
I do not support introducing the current period book yield approach. As I've thought through it, and I agree with the staff that it's finally balanced in terms of pros and cons, so that drives me to stepping back and saying, if the objective is cost-based measure, if somebody is choosing to disaggregate, it's because presumably they think it's important to produce cost-based information in the profit or loss statement. If cost-based information is important in the profit or loss statement, then because I agree with the statement you just made in response to Steve, I don't see the book yield approach is giving an actual cost of the liability information. So the thing that I would presume would drive the reason for selecting disaggregation, because I think it's important to put cost-based information in profit or loss, isn't being achieved by the method of calculating costs. You've got something that's driven by eliminating the accounting mismatches. And when I think back through eliminating accounting mismatches, long ago and far away at the starting point of this project, one of the practices that we were encouraged to consider was discounting liabilities at the asset return rate. And the reason we don't pick discounting liabilities at the asset return rate is because we want to account separately for the assets and for the liabilities, and then see how each has done. And to me, measuring cost of the liability and the profit or loss on the basis of the accounting changes in the assets, because that seems to be what's driving the calculation of the book yield, leads me to say that erodes further the meaningfulness of the P&L. As a measurement of cost, so I'm a no, question one, no.
Maybe just a question for staff on this. I can see both sides of the argument on the subjective thing. I think the difficulty is when I'm looking at a liability, I'm looking at a single liability, and I'm getting a mixture of cost-based and fair value. If I cut the liability into the piece that directly sits opposite an amortized cost asset and the piece that sits directly opposite a fair value profit and loss asset, I can then express the objective as for one part trying to achieve the cost outcome and for the other part trying to achieve a fair value outcome. The difficulty is obviously I can't artificially cut the liability up into pieces. In many ways, to me, that's the unique advantage of CBY, is it allows me to do something that ordinarily I would not be able to do, and in so doing, achieves matching. All of that aside, I'm just wondering whether we are potentially kind of chasing a bit of a red herring here. The CBY approach achieves two things. For the cost element of the underlying, it achieves a cost-based measurement. For the fair value, it achieves a fair value measurement. Together, the two parts achieve a matching outcome, an accounting or the avoidance of an accounting mismatch. In the non-PAR book, essentially I've got my cost-based objective that we agreed upon that achieves the cost versus cost, and I've got the option that allows me to avoid mismatches. And it seems to me it's two different ways of getting at the same thing. And I'm just wondering whether the whole kicking around of this thing about how the objective needs to be clear and et cetera, isn't necessarily as important as the outcome we're trying to achieve, which seems to be similar in both circumstances.
Yes, but if I could come in. On the non-PAR, and correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, we say that you need to choose whether you do cost or current and apply it consistently for all the liabilities. So if you've got a mix of cost and current assets, you don't achieve a match.
You have to find a way to do it. So what you're going to end up with is you're going to have portfolios that are predominantly one, and then you'll go with that.
Yeah, do we also see similar portfolios need to be accounted for in a similar accounting policy? So there's some limits on that. What the current period book yield does is allows you essentially to do that splitting up in a way.
Correct.
So you've got a difference there, and I think that's why we don't see it as a cost-based measure. It's a mix of cost and current in those situations.
Build on that, sorry, Pat. Oh, it's a question. It's a question really for Steve, because if I listen to the staff, I get the sense they're quite firm that they don't see current period book yield as a cost measure. They see it as something different objective. But Steve, were you rather than dismissing current period book yield out of hand, rather suggesting that if our objective was a cost-based measurement, that in some cases the outcome could be, in effect, the current book yield. So rather than saying you don't want it, you see it as being something on the spectrum of what this cost outcome could be, depending on what your circumstances were.
Yes, I like Daryl's articulation of it. I think it would just be simpler if we could have one objective. That's all I'm trying to do, is to make whatever we end up with as simple as possible. I can understand what you're saying about isn't really cost, but then this effective yield, modified, updated, adjusted, that's not really cost either.
But it is cost, because amortized cost does update in certain circumstances when it's variable cash flows that we accept it. This crediting rate could change for a variety of reasons. Nothing could be nothing to the assets, but it's still a reflection of cost, because that's how much you credit in the period.
But because of this close link and this narrow range of circumstances, doesn't it mean that in effect, because what's going on with the asset drives what's happening on the liability, that you do get this connection between the two?
I think that the difference here then is because the assets are shorter than liability, it's the gains and losses when those assets are sold and churned.
Mm.
So under the effective yield approach, it's whatever it is, it might reset, but it will not react necessarily to these gains and losses being sold. Particular periods when you hit, whereas in this one it would take that into account.
Yeah.
The other difference is it could be potentially a mixture of cost and current. If your assets are cost and current, your current period book yield is a mixture of cost and current.
And an extreme, if it's all current, then
yes,
your current period book yield is in fact
current.
And
that's again something that feels different to us than the effective yield approach, which is only cost.
Can I ask a question to Zygmunt?
Yes, even if
he's had the final word.
Even if it would qualify as a cost measure, then we need additional guidance, because I think we would only allow the current book yield approach if you don't have economic mismatches.
That's correct.
So
yes.
Even
yes.
If it would fall under the cost measure, we...
You could express it that way, but you do have to express this slightly nuanced it. Why, in that situation, you're allowed to have a bit of current and a bit of cost in it. And that's all we're trying to say, to make it clear that it's actually okay if your assets are current, that current period book yield reflects that current thing, which under effective yield, it would not.
In listening to the discussion, I think I'm more in Daryl's camp. I actually believe that we need a current period book yield approach. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because one of the points I think this conversation is overlooking is the importance of the criteria for getting into the variable fee approach. Now, the way the paper is presented, it's as if those criteria are very discrete and we're going to know exactly what the population of those contracts are going to be. And so this process, frankly, of potentially moving in and out of, you know, the current period book yield approach to an effective yield approach, I don't know, is going to be an exception. It's not going to happen all that much. I don't know. But I would think that if that were to occur quite often, that would really make the financial statements completely unintelligible. I worry about having two different ways of determining interest expense to be presented in P&L. So I think it's very important to have a current period book yield approach. I think it's also very important not to have a hair trigger on the designation of contracts that are perceived not to qualify any longer for them. But from a starting point, I actually believe it's more important to have a more crisp definition of what is actually going to go into that population. And the reason why I think this is important is because I believe that the display of interest, income, and expense in P&L really should follow the path of the book yield, whether these are assets at cost or whether they're at fair value P&L. So when you come back to these criteria at the beginning of the paper, I've been struggling with this now for 6 or 7 months. I've raised this on several occasions on exactly how to interpret these criteria. And to my mind, this drives the soundness of this outcome. But if I were to lean one way, clearly have a current period book yield approach. I agree with Daryl that you could get to the same outcome when you have cost-based assets by electing the fair value option. I don't think we should force that on insurers because we've created a mixed measurement attribute model. And then we're going to create an accounting mismatch mm-hmm. on them in P&L. We shouldn't do that to them. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't make sense either. So having the current period book yield approach, I think, is absolutely sound. And I actually don't think we should be forcing a transition or flip-flopping between that and effective yield. I really think that would be an unsound outcome. So, as I've said before, I'd like to see one whole model, but at least have a clear distinction between par and non-par, and the way interest is determined, and not have par defined so narrowly that we're going to potentially have, in this particular case, three different outcomes, you know, variable fee, effective yield, and then something that in the non-par area would be similar to effective yield, but might not be exactly the same. So,
and then, that's
kind of where.
I agree with the current period book yield approach, but I'm already perplexed. Several months ago, we discussed about this same issue. At that time, there was a kind of pros and cons. One of the maybe cons is the reason is this is the current period book yield approach is not consistent with the cost-based measurement because we are recognizing the current rate at the beginning of the period, the current rate will be applied to calculate this kind of interest or investment expense. So at that time, there are, you know, among us, there are some kind of, or maybe half and half, you know, we are discussed whether we should accept or not. Another thing is, first, we as I said before, there, I guess it seems to me the contracts are different, their account standards are different from us, but looks like they stick to their cost-based model. So it looks like effective yield approach only, not including in the current period book yield approach. So I am a little, wondering why we are just all going to this new approach without any some kind of a careful consideration of these two things. So could you explain to why this approach is much better than before, maybe several months ago?
Sorry, which approach? I'm not
the current period boogie approach.
Which approach compared
to effective interest rate?
Well, I think the main benefit of this approach is it eliminates accounting mismatches.
Yeah, I understand. That's at the time linear. There was the same point why
yes.
We should accept this current period, but there was a disadvantage of this approach too.
Chung, well, you're talking about several months ago when Connor presented a paper that walked through the different approaches, I think, and the concerns that were expressed then about current book yield not creating some problems, and some of those problems seem to have gone away from when Connor presented to now.
Well, I think we've been talking a lot about current period book yield and effective yield in education sessions. I think we have refined our vision of what current period book yield will be in a number of those sessions, and reformulated it from the proposals that originally came from constituents into a way that's made it a lot simpler to articulate and understand. So I think from that point of view, it is the benefit of it appears to be clearer than it did originally. I think in terms of the costs and benefits, they're pretty much the same as we've discussed in the education sessions, but I think the difference is today we're asking for a decision.
Can I ask a question just to clarify? In paragraph 9A, what do you think would need to be the degree of economic mismatch that might arise in order to kick you out of current period book yield approach? How do you come to that judgment?
Well, in principle, it would be materiality.
Materiality effect on P&L?
Well, I guess it would be materiality full stop. So anything that's going to change your view of things.
Shall we try to answer question one?
Are you going to propose a modified question with an option? Or
no, I'll start with this, and if this fails, then we can talk about the option. So, firstly, when the entity disaggregates changes between profit and loss and OCI, and they meet the criteria for no economic mismatches, this would be the approach that would be applied, the current period book yield approach. In agenda paper 2D, we're talking about whether to give an option to go to all current measurement profit and loss. So just to be clear, so if you do meet the criteria for no economic mismatches, this would be the approach to disaggregate between profit and loss and OCI.
That
do you wish to object?
Mandatory. In your question, you
assuming
have to do it.
Or P&L. This or P&L only.
No, but this current
only.
Book
yes.
yield as mandatory if you qualify,
yes.
as opposed to
yes.
an option to use current book yield and
or
an option not to.
Yes.
It doesn't allow an option between effective yield and current period book yield.
Exactly.
So if you meet these criteria and you want to disaggregate between profit and loss and OCI, it would be this.
Okay. But we're still going to ask the question about the optionality.
Of course,
later,
P&L.
Right?
Yeah. Option
so
to P&L,
question,
P&L is
the
P&L,
to
not
the
to EY, to P&L.
So this question.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Sit without the cutting board. Okay, so question two. I'm going to reformulate question two. So everything is the same except for B. Okay. So B will be changed to 15A. Which is that the amounts that remained in the accumulated OCI would be recognized over the life according to the assumptions based on the date of the change. So can people agree to that one? So
So it's all
everybody.
Okay, thank you. Then the
before you go, I think I heard from at least Philippe and Daryl on question one that they thought that there should be a choice between effective yield and book yield. Are you going to
not Daryl, no. Only Philippe.
Okay.
I said a choice between CBY and current.
So that's current.
And I made it clear that the
I knew you made it clear in the vote. I didn't know if there were more people who wanted to make it optional.
No.
Okay.
So in agenda paper 2D, we have two other issues. Plus, I'm aware that we still need to vote on the first small question that was asked in the beginning of the session. Just very briefly. This paper addresses both the accounting policy choice. I think we've talked at length at that, so I'm not proposing to tease it out in very much detail. So that's discussed in paragraph 7 to 14. Basically, we see the same compelling reasons of giving the accounting policy choice for contracts without participation features to also apply to contracts with participation features. This includes those using the effective yield approach and those that could qualify for the current period book yield approach.
Vote?
Sorry? Sue?
I just was confused about this accounting policy choice. So my recollection from when we did the general model was it was just a free choice, but that you had to then apply it consistently for similar types of portfolios, but you didn't have to justify your way into it.
You didn't have to justify it, but in B, which is a previous decision, so if you look at question 1B, question 1A, B, and C is just a replicate of your previous decisions.
Yeah, but that just says you have to apply it in a consistent way. It's not you have to justify it.
No, but you have to take into account the following when you're doing it. B.
Portfolio.
1B.
But that to me just meant you had to do it consistently for similar portfolios.
Yes,
not you
and
had to justify.
No, it's not justified.
It's not justified. It's a accounting policy.
All right, on that basis.
Okay.
So question one?
Question one? Accounting policy choice? 13.1. 1 and 2. So now moving on to, can I now go back to the first small question or should I just finish?
And question 2.
And question 2 together. Also question 2?
Question 2.
Which is the for current period book year to give an accounting policy choice?
Can I? Why do we need to do this? Because if your assets are fair value P&L, there is no adjustment to the liability automatically.
That's correct. It's not on accounting mismatches that you would give an option for. It is the complexity argument. So if you had, potentially, you were worried about flipping in and out of current period book yield, would you want to give the accounting policy choice to address the complexity of that situation?
We also have a chicken and egg situation here in that the way that you would fix it is to say my liability is at fair value, therefore I will exercise the fair value option on all my assets to make them all fair value too. But if my liability doesn't start out at fair value, if my liability starts out at reflecting my assets, I'm not sure I can get to the asset fair value option.
You could if the assets are amortized cost, but that's a slight another issue.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm being slow again, changing gears. Can you explain to me though why we need a further in agenda paper 2D question 2? Why, having reached the decision we did in 2C, why we need a further option here? So you've got a choice between current. That's the vote on question one.
But that one's only for effective yield. Only one. Question one is only for effective yield.
And question two is for current period book yield.
And you're on CBI. Yeah.
If we have a proposal, we don't have to.
So if I could, exactly. So I think this is the reason the question split up is really essentially to Steve's point. So for a current period book yield situation, then if the assets were all at fair value P&L, then the current period book yield would be fair value P&L. So essentially, you get to the same outcome as electing the option to go to fair value P&L.
to Joanna's point, what she's saying is that there may be situations where you might be on the cusp of failing or qualifying for the current period book yield, and rather than choose an OCI method and be forced into EY and then current period book yield backwards and forwards, you might instead prefer to just exercise the accounting policy choice and have everything through P&L.
Yes.
I think then someone else said, Daryl perhaps, that there's a chicken and egg pat, was it? Pat, sorry. There's a chicken and egg situation in whether or not you have the ability to go to fair value P&L on the assets, because that depends on there being a mismatch. And if there hadn't been a mismatch, then could you actually get both sides up to fair value P&L? So in short, it might simplify things if you were to say yes to question two.
With this clarification.
So 5, 6, 7, 13.
Is it an extended salary option in a way? Is it an extension of a salary option when there is no economic mismatch?
It's saying we will give you a menu of about 6 different choices for how you can select the basis on which you will do your P&L.
Well, no, for
and if you find this method too complex, you can go this way.
Well, for any one situation, you've got a choice of two. I think what Philippe had been proposing might have given you a choice of three.
Yes.
But we're seeing in any particular set of circumstances, you have the choice of through P&L
OCI
or some sort of OCI thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So, shall we move on to the simple? Yeah, let's just finish this paper and move back to the simple question on question one. So the next issue that discussed in agenda paper 2D is the simplified approach on transition. So just a recap, what the model proposes is retrospective application of the proposals on the first application of the standard. So to do, if you want to do an insurance investment expense at cost, you need historical information. That historical information may not always be there. We have already given a simplification for contracts without participation features. So we've given a simplification to determine the discount rates at the date the contract was incepted. So it is fairly simple then to calculate what your insurance investment expense should be at cost for contracts without participation features. This paper has to do with contracts with participation features and whether you should give a simplification when retrospective is difficult. It's impossible, sorry. God, it's on my mind. We looked at whether you could give a simplification that approximated retrospective application. And staff concluded that it was very difficult to do so. And this is because the insurance investment expense is a factor of what was remaining in your accumulated OCI in the previous period. Is that you really, what you're doing then is putting the putting the changes in discount rate in OCI and then resetting the insurance investment expense in future periods to make sure that it's recognized in a systematic way all across the life of the contract. So you kind of need historical information of each period, what are the amounts you've been putting into your OCI and therefore how much you've been taking out as well in each period. So staff analyzed and said, well, what simplifications could we give anyway? So you could look at it in paragraph 25. You could give the simplification in paragraph 25. You could give the same one you gave the contracts without participation features, which is the discount rate at inception and assume that nothing's have changed since that. You could also give the one that, well, it's the cost-based measurement starts today. It starts using the assumptions based and the date of transition or the date when you first apply the standard. Accordingly, the accumulated balance in OCI is zero. None of this is actually a simplification that gets you closer to retrospective application. None of this, to be clear. Because of that, I just went with the simplest one, which is B, which is to base it on the facts you know today, so the changes in macro variables would start from today, and accumulated OCI would be zero. So this applies only to contracts with the effective year. So that's the first simplification. Now we've got current period book yield, and that's in paragraphs 30 to 34. And here again, I'm providing, I think, a simplification that does get you closer to if you were applying current period book yield retrospectively. And that's just to assume that the assets you hold today, base it on the assets you hold today. good. It's good. Thank you, Philip.
Question about paragraph 15. I think this is talking about the scope. And paragraph 15 says that those cash flows are the predominant type of cash flows, and such contract include most contract with the participation features. So that means the most of the indirect power would be included in this scope.
If you have a participation feature and those additional benefits arise because of change to the market variables, yes, it would be within the scope.
So then
because that would be the situation where you would apply an OCI approach, where you'd be resetting the OCI approach as you keep on going along.
So unless the contract is not a pure non-par contract, then most would be...
It's hard for me to say whether most or more, but what you need to have is a participation feature, and the additional benefits that you're paying out of participation feature has to be affected by changes in market variables.
Market variables, that linked cash flows.
Could an entity prior to the effective date of the standard modify contracts to insert a participation feature in order to benefit from this?
Have they got a different contract then?
The trouble with this, the problem we had with non-par in resetting the OCI to zero is that you would have zero accumulated OCI on the liability, you potentially will have unrealized gains on the assets which are in OCI, and then for subsequent periods you have that disconnect and potential to increase P&L earnings. And we have exactly the same thing here as a result of this modification. Are we going to have any special disclosures to highlight to the poor investors that they're going to be faced with this potentially for many years?
I think that's what we suggested in paragraph 28. So we, as we discussed on Wednesday, we are our intention is to bring back presentation and disclosures once we know where the model is at. So one of those for consideration. So we, if you have any suggestions or recommendations, I think we definitely would consider it if the board voted for this recommendation. So any ideas?
I was going to raise exactly the same point, not the disclosure point, but to ask whether hadn't we in the past had an issue with the mismatch that this creates with the associated assets and the fact that we're going to get a sort of asymmetric effect coming through over time.
I think it is an unfortunate result is the asymmetric reflect, yes.
Yes, one more comment before we vote. I like your proposal, definitely. And this is the very good proposal. However, the reasoning I really don't like. The reasoning is because it's not practical, then we allow this. Yes, that's fine. But if it's practicable, then you have to do the kind of full retrospective. So that's the idea of IS 8. However, in this particular case, not in this particular case, but in this insurance case, I think the idea of the idea you extended in the paper 2C, paragraph 13, which is that in that situation, it was appropriate. Then it's not appropriate to ask them to restate. That's what you described in your paper 2C, paragraph 13. I think that idea is more suitable for this situation, rather than just depending on the practicability. Because if we solely depend on the practicability, then we could invite some scope creep. So therefore, I think the idea should be something like a paper 2C, paragraph 13.
I think the idea in paragraph 2C was to say that current period book yield is applicable this period, so I don't need to restate in prior periods. The board has decided to have retrospective application of the standard, which means the proposals have applied since the beginning of the standard. If we go with the approach in that paper 2C, no CSM. CSM would start from the date of the contract when on transition. Is that what you want, Tao?
Oh, good question.
I was going to say something similar to what Joe just did, because I don't think it's really the same, because in one case we're saying something changed in the economics which caused the accounting to change, so retrospective is inappropriate, whereas here we're talking about transition in the context of something we wanted to be retrospective, so I'm not sure they're
One is an accounting thing, one is an economic thing.
Economic.
Okay, have you read the vote?
Yeah.
So, one against? Yes. Okay, can I have 5 minutes of your time and now refer back to where we started, which is agenda paper 2B, question one.
What was
this? Agenda paper 2B. Question one, on page four. Yes, just to be clear, this question is asking, changes in the amount of cash flows that result from changes in market variables should be reported in the same location in the table of comprehensive income, in brackets, i.e. profit or loss, or OCI, depending on the entity's accounting policy election.
Yes, supported.
Okay. Since you were asking questions.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12-2.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Except when it is a guarantee that goes against you.
2 minutes.
It's not 15 minutes.
You ask it for 5 minutes, you still have three.
Okay. I've run out of jokes today.
Thanks for a very heavy insurance week.
Comment was a joke, but it wasn't. I think we have to be careful in the drafting that we don't create an inadvertent conflict in the drafting of the standard, so that it raises questions about the variable fee approach piece that's supposed to be CSM.
Yes.
I think in our minds we do measurement first and then present changes which come
after that.
So we should hopefully be able to get it clear.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. And happy week.
Thank you.
Friday still to come.
Yeah, nice board.